Mr. President, members of the faculty, and students, we have with us today Dr. Aldous Huxley, an internationally famous writer, the author of more than 40 books, including nearly every form of literary invention, novels, essays, short stories, biographical and historical studies, plays, and film scenarios. Among his novels, I'm sure you know Brave New World, Chrome Yellow, Point Counterpoint, and Ape and Essence. It was in 1959 that he received an award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters for, quote, having done the best work of our time in the novel of ideas. Dr. Huxley was born in England, was educated at Eton College and Oxford University. Because of failing eyesight, he gave up his first and perhaps most cherished goal of medicine and received instead a degree in English literature. Since 1940, he has lived in the United States, and for the past year, he has been very close to us in educational circles because he has been a professor at large at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Presently, he is in Topeka, as you may know, as a visiting professor on the Albert P. Sloan plan at the Menninger Foundation. He will speak on a topic different than that announced in the program. He will speak to us this morning on the topic, human potentiality. We welcome to our campus, Dr. Aldous Huxley.
Members of the faculty and students, I'm sorry about this change of subject matter, which is entirely my fault. I'm afraid I'm rather like the old man in Edward Lear's nonsense book, the old man of Thermopylae, who never did anything properly. And I've evidently got muddled in regard to the subject matter and made notes on something else. However, I think this other subject of human potentialities and the means by which some at least of them can be realized in a society like our own is a profoundly interesting and important subject, so I will make no further excuses for going ahead with it. Well, the first thing to be noted in this question of human potentialities is that biological evolution probably stopped about the, or became quite insignificant by the upper Paleolithic. And for the last 30 or 40,000 years, there has been probably almost no genetic change of any significance in the human makeup. And that everything that we've done since then, all the potentialities which we have realized, were potentialities latent in the Paleolithic man, which have been brought out by the process of language, of passing on information from one generation to another, and by the general cultural processes. This, I think, gives one great ground for optimism. I think it's quite clear, most of us, I think, are profoundly conscious of the fact that we are all functioning at about, 10-15% of capacity, and maybe that we could function at a great deal, at a great, much higher level, if somehow the means could be found for eliciting the potentialities which lie within us. They are, as I say, I think, still very great, and I think that it is conceivable that the potentialities which can be realized from this time forth are as great as those which have already been realized in comparison with the a Paleolithic man. If this is so, then we have indeed an extraordinary prospect in front of us. I shall, before discussing the means of of eliciting, actualizing these potentialities, let me begin by relating potentialities to human needs. Human needs, I think, can be placed in a kind of hierarchy from the most fundamental up to the most rarefied. And at the bottom of the scale, we obviously have the biological needs, the need of food, the need for safety, including shelter and so forth. And these, of course, are absolutely primary. Man cannot live by bread alone, but he certainly cannot live without bread. And that he cannot even be aware of his higher needs unless these biological needs are satisfied. Well, then, above the primary biological needs, we have what may be called the primary psychological needs. And among these, I think, clearly is the need for love. It has been shown quite clearly by modern psychology that a child brought up without sufficient love in its earliest years becomes a kind of moral imbecile and extremely sick mentally. So that this is a necessity almost as great as the biological necessity for food and safety. And then there is the need for a sense of belongingness. This is a very important need, a need for respect from other people, a need for self-respect too. I mean, these seem to me, as you go up the scale of the needs, very, very important psychological needs. Well, beyond these, we have the what may be called the more rarefied human needs. The need, for example, for knowledge, the curiosity, the desire for knowledge, which is so strong in human beings and which is the basis, after all, of all developments in science and philosophy. This is a need. Then there is the need for meaning, the desire to impose upon the world by means of symbols a meaning and sense. The world as it's presented to us directly is, in William James's words, a blooming, buzzing confusion. And we have to use our minds and our symbol systems in order to impose some kind of order and meaning upon it. Then there is the need for expression, which is felt very strongly by certain people with artistic gifts, and I think it's true of everybody to some extent. It is a real human need. And finally, there is the need, which some of the people feel quite consciously and strongly, and all I think feel in a somewhat obscure way, the need for growth, the need precisely for actualizing the potentialities which lie within us. Well, it's quite clear that the more rarefied of these needs, the more exclusively and characteristically human of the needs, cannot be fulfilled unless the needs on the lower level are satisfied. We have to have food, we have to have safety, we have to have the basic psychological satisfaction before we can get on to the development of these, first of all, to the realization of these higher needs, and a fortiori to the actualization of the potentialities connected with these needs. Now, in relation to a given culture, what is the position of the human being, his potentiality? Quite clearly, any given culture is at once a kind of hothouse for fostering the growth of human potentialities, but it is also a prison. We cannot go beyond, it's exceedingly difficult anyhow for any but the most exceptional people, to go beyond the walls of their culture, so that we are both the beneficiaries and the victims of the civilization in which we live. And of course, the more primitive and simple the society, the more close and tight are the boundaries within which a man can move. Consider, for example, the case of a child with an IQ, say, of 150, born into a Paleolithic household, or cave hold, whatever the word may be, 30 or 40,000 years ago. However high his IQ may have been, and it's quite obvious from genetic considerations that there were exceptionally gifted children at every period of the world's history, however high the IQ may have been, it would have been impossible within that civilization for the most gifted child to become more than a hunter and food collector. There was just no possibility of chance of this. Whereas a child born into a highly complex variegated civilization such as we have has enormous opportunities. I mean, there are many ways he can develop, many tasks to which he can apply himself, many systems of thought from which he can choose. Even within a given culture, he has a degree of liberty of choice which has never existed, of course, in the past. And this is, I think, a profoundly important fact. Well, now it is quite clear from what we've said about the nature of culture that the maximum of human potentialities in individuals will never be developed except in an absolutely perfect society. Well, of course, it's highly unlikely that we shall ever have a perfect society, and I am not going in this lecture to try to lay down a blueprint for such a society. I am instead going to talk about what could be done within a society such as ours to improve the possibilities of individuals actualizing the innumerable latent potentialities that they have. Before we get down to actual techniques, let us first consider the individual, individuals rather, it's no good using a generalized term in relation to individuals, in relation to society at large. And biologically speaking, of course, the most striking fact about the human species is that it is more highly variable than any other species. In general, the variability of species, of individuals within a species, seems to increase as we go up the evolutionary scale, and it is at its highest in the human species. And needless to say, the differences between people, the fact that we are not all the same, but we are profoundly different. We have many things in common, but we have many things that are different from one another, and every individual is unique. It is this biological fact which, of course, is the basis and reason for our belief and desire for personal freedom and our cherishing of democratic institutions. If, in fact, all individuals were alike, then there would be no objection at all to any one individual at the top of the social pyramid from saying what should be done by everybody, because what was good for him would be good for everybody else. And there would be no objection to a totalitarian regime. But owing to the fact that we are, each one of us, unique, and that we can be classified only in quite a wide spectrum of variability, because of this, personal freedom is immensely precious, tolerance is a very high virtue, and democratic institutions are an extremely useful method of government. And I would say that one of the ways in which potentialities in individuals may be developed to a higher pitch than they are now is by a completer recognition of this fact of variability. We must remember that we are all unique, and that people of different temperaments have a perfect right to be what they are, and they have a perfect right to be helped to develop their personalities along the lines which their genetic makeup has laid down. A great deal of work along these lines has been done by Professor Roger Williams of the University of Texas, who has written a number of books on the subject. I recommend an excellent book of his called A Free and Unequal, and another, the excellent book too, on the biochemical personalities, I mean, points out that there are these striking differences between human beings, and that we must accept the fact. Well, within the realm of education, I think this is a very important consideration. We have already recognized the possibilities of differential education. We have, after all, special education for backward children, and special education in some cases for very remarkably exceptionally intelligent children. But I think this principle which has been recognized can be extended still further, and it's that it would be possible to get a great deal more out of the educational process if we did recognize the essential differences between people and molded our educational system accordingly. For example, I mean, even in such a rarefied field as mathematics, you have some people who are temperamentally geometers and others who are temperamentally algebraic, and think in terms of completely abstract terms. This is a very intellectual differentiation. But there are many, on the psychological and emotional level, it is again quite clear that we should make allowances for the profound differences of temperament between people. We should, for example, not insist that all young people should conform to one particular ideal. The sort of bouncing, extroverted, good mixer has become very much an ideal. But it is perfectly obvious that many people are incapable of becoming bouncing, extroverted, good mixers because their temperament is introverted and inhibited. And they have a perfect right to their temperament, and they have a perfect right to be helped to develop all the potentialities that lie within them along the lines of this temperament, and not to be suppressed and thwarted and frustrated by being asked to become what in fact they are not. So I think here is an important facet of this educational problem in relation to the development of potentiality. Well then, before we get down to actual techniques, let us touch very briefly on a subject which is coming to be quite significant, I think, now. The subject of chemical means for changing, or to some extent changing, mental states. This meant, needless to say, men have always attempted to use chemical means to change a mental state, and they have used, unfortunately, extremely dangerous methods for producing this state of things. They've used alcohol and opium and cocaine, all of which are dangerous drugs. But the most striking fact in the development of modern pharmacology is the creation of a number of mind-changing drugs which can be taken with a minimum of ill effects upon the physiology. And it is a very interesting fact, which was announced a year or two ago. The Russians are said to have embarked upon a five-year plan in the realm of pharmacology to develop pharmacological means for increasing mental efficiency among human beings, for increasing alertness, staying power, span of attention, and so on. And I have talked with the various pharmacologists who say this is perfectly possible, that it may be within quite a few years conceivable that a kind of nutritional additive will actually permit a greater degree of mental efficiency than is possible to most people in most circumstances now. Well, of course, it's quite clear that this would be an enormous asset to society at large if everybody was even, say, 2% more efficient mentally than they are now, and if they were as much as 5 or 10% more efficient, this would make a colossal difference. So that this is certainly not to be neglected. Now let us get down to the whole problem of more conventional forms of education. Here, there has been, of course, much searching apart in recent years over the problem of excessive specialization. What has happened, I mean, for example, in a place like Caltech or at MIT, is a tremendous effort has been made to temper the purely scientific specialization in physics and chemistry and so forth with a considerable dose of the humanities. And this is all for the good. I mean, it is very desirable that technicians should be civilized. Unfortunately, my own feeling is that this doesn't really go quite far enough. The mere addition of studies in the humanities to a specialized scientific curriculum doesn't really answer all the questions. For the simple reason that the humanities, as they are taught now, are predominantly, of course, verbal. We teach, we are in literature and in philosophy and so on, we are teaching people to study what has been said by older, by people in the past, in terms of this, of the language system which we have inherited. So that we have still a high level of what may be called symbolic specialization. We are in science, to a considerable extent anyhow, concerned with symbols. And in the humanities, as they are now taught, we are also even further concerned with symbols. So that our education is probably disproportionately on the symbolic side. We can envisage human beings like icebergs as floating in the world of immediate experience and projecting out into the winds of doctrine, the symbolic world, above the surface of the immediate experience. And obviously we have to live in both worlds. But as things stand now in our current systems of education, I think in all parts of the world, we are too much, seems to me, preoccupied with the part above the surface, the symbolic area of man's life, and too little preoccupied with the what lies below in the world of immediate experience. Now, what this world of immediate experience, if you start teaching this, you start training people to in this world, you have entered a field of what may be called the non-verbal humanity. I would like to see this very much introduced into any system of education, a systematic exploration of what can be done in this field of the non-verbal humanity. Naturally, something has been done already. I mean, we have education in music and in art and so on, but again, I don't think it is sufficient. We haven't yet systematically started to train the mind body, which is the thing which has to do the learning and the living. We leave this remarkably untrained as a whole, and it is time, I feel very strongly, that we should investigate this untrained mind-body, which is the whole basis of our existence, and see what can be done to bring it up to a higher pitch of mental and physical efficiency, and thereby to permit the realization of greater numbers of desirable potentialities. One finds, for example, a striking phrase in Spinoza where he says, teach the body many things, for in this way you will perfect the intellect, perfect the mind, and enable yourself to come to the intellectual love of God. This is a very surprising phrase, but the more you think of it, the more interesting it is. I mean, Spinoza was an extremely realistic philosopher. He was perfectly aware that man is a body as well as a soul,
a person with first order experiences as well as symbolic experiences, and that the body must be taught in a great variety of ways if the mind is to develop to the full. And this, I think, could well become a motto of the education of the future. Well, let us consider a few fields in which this kind of training in the non-verbal humanities might be of great value. First of all, what about training in perception? This, after all, is absolutely fundamental to everything we do. It is on the basis of perception that we think and feel and act and do everything. And yet very little is done in this matter of training perception. A great deal, I think, could be done, much more than is being done now. We could... there are a number of ways which we can approach this problem of becoming more acutely aware of what we perceive, of perceiving more discriminatingly, of perceiving more rapidly. A great deal of empirical work has, of course, been done in this field. I'm thinking of the work, for example, of Professor Renshaw at the University of Ohio with the tachistoscope, and there are endless ways, I think, in which this training in perception could be improved. But after all, take the case of seeing. Seeing is like talking, it is a learned art. And for one reason or another, many children never learn to see very well. Seeing, after all, is both physical and mental. It is the interpretation of sense impressions which come in, mental interpretation of physiological events on the retina and in the brain. And again, here a lot of empirical work has been done, and I think it is perfectly clear that this could easily be applied on almost every level of education, from the kindergarten upwards, to improve the quality of seeing. And the same thing, I think, can be done with all the other senses. Renshaw, for example, has found that any group of undergraduates can be trained in 6 weeks to have a discriminatory sense of taste as good as that of a professional tea taster or whiskey taster, which is very high, incidentally. It doesn't necessarily have to be applied to whiskey. But I think the mere fact of having this higher degree of discrimination and of sensitivity and of rapidity of reaction in all the fields of perception does probably add greatly to a human being's enjoyment of life, I think. I mean, the world seems a great deal more interesting than it does to people with a rather dull range of perception. I think there is also quite a lot of evidence that where perception has been trained, there is a remarkable increase in general intelligence, in the way that the child reacts to purely intellectual matters. There is an important field here, I think, for a general improvement of mental efficiency. And this whole matter of increasing awareness, I think, is of great importance. After all, from the time of Socrates, we've been saying, know thyself. But like so many ideals, we formulate the ideal, but we provide no means whereby it may be implemented. We make resolutions on New Year's Day, but we don't say how we're to keep the resolution. And I think that in this matter of knowing ourselves, here is an immensely important field for actually doing something which in the long run may lead not merely to important intellectual but important spiritual consequences. I mean, within all the
great religious tradition, it has always been insisted that the self-knowledge is one of the most basic means of approach to the divine, that it is through knowing who you are, where you stand, what are your deficiencies, where you want to go, and in trying to modify your deficiencies in a positive way. It is only in this way that you can make advances towards the ultimate goal of union with the divine. And here once more we see a great deal of empirical work which has been done in many fields on these techniques of improving awareness. I will quote a few recent ones. There's a valuable book came out about 5 or 6 years ago called Gestalt Therapy by 3 authors, Pearl, Pfefferlein and Goodman, which is a very interesting book containing a very large number of exercises for increasing awareness of the outer world, of what is happening within the body, of what is happening within the mind, and which is not only useful in general, but it has also been found to have a remarkable therapeutic effect. I think the therapeutic effect is due to the simple fact that almost any neurosis can be defined as a state in which the person is living here and now as though he were living in the past. He is responding to the challenges of the moment in terms of what may be called post-hypnotic suggestions given him as a result of traumatic experiences when he was much younger. So that the goal of any of psychotherapy is really to bring human beings, the sick person, up to present time, to here and now. And one of the ways of doing it, of course, is through the analytical method of getting back to the causes and then trying to abreact and get rid of them. The other method is precisely as the authors of Gestalt Therapy have insisted, to train people to become aware of actually what is happening here and now. I mean, what does it feel like just to lift your hand? What exactly is the color of this table in front of you? All these things, when we become completely aware, we are then living here and now, and it is possible then the habit may become so strong of living here and now that these, so to say, post-hypnotic suggestions out of the past may no longer affect us as they do. And my own feeling is that these methods probably will be used to a greater and greater extent in therapy, and they can be used, I think, as preventive methods to prevent people from getting into the state where they require therapy. And as a matter of historical interest, this kind of method has been used long before the authors of Gestalt Therapy used it. It was used 14, 50 years ago by a very eminent Swiss psychiatrist, Dr. Vito, who certainly had as good results with neurotics as anybody else has ever had, entirely through this method of getting people to be aware of what it felt like to be here and now, of what every movement of, and you would do these very simple exercises of getting people to be aware of external objects, of moving the hand, to be aware in a completely receptive way, and as I say, achieved very remarkable results along these lines. Then, not merely perception has to be trained, but on another field in which I think very valuable results have been achieved in a sporadic and empirical way, but it can be achieved in a much more systematic way, is in the training of the imagination. We all live a great deal of our lives in the world of fancy and imagination, and again, it has been shown by a number of people in different fields that you can make use of this power in very valuable ways. I think at present we tend to let it sort of flow away, to run like a leaking tap, and not to direct it. But there is, as I said, plenty of evidence that imagination can be used in a very effective manner to raise the general efficiency of the whole psychophysical organism. I don't think I can go into the details of this, but anybody who wishes to study what can be done in the field of imagination should read, for example, the Herbert Reed's book, Education Through Art, which has most interesting chapters on the ways in which imagination can be trained so as to contribute to the general effectiveness of the human being as a whole. And those who are interested in the training of children, I recommend a very interesting little book by DeMille called Imagination Games, which shows very clearly how the child can make use of imagination both to enrich his own life and to preserve himself against many of the shocks to which children are subject. For example, a very simple game which I've seen being played very effectively by children, which you teach it to them. A child, for example, has a great fear of some adult, some person in his environment. Well, if his imagination, you can teach him to use his imagination in this way, that he can think of this person in, say, rather absurd situations. A very good game, for example, is to imagine this person multiplied 5 times, 10 times, 20 times. There's 20 of these creatures running about, and preferably dressed in ridiculous clothes or doing something ridiculous. It is an amazingly good way of preserving the child from these kind of obsessional fears which do so much to prevent the realization of our potentiality. As I say, I can't go any further into this, but it is a most interesting and important subject to pursue. Then I would also like to mention the fact that these exercises in awareness are by no means modern inventions. When we turn to the literature of the Orient, we find that this kind of exercise has been used for literally thousands of years in the East. It has been used primarily as a kind of spiritual exercise of preparing people for the sort of ultimate change in consciousness that is called enlightenment or liberation, whatever you like to call it. And a very interesting text, for example, can be found among the Buddhist tantric writings. The text is always curious. It begins with a dialogue between Parvati, the wife of the god Shiva, who asks Shiva what is the secret of his extraordinary form of consciousness, his enlightened consciousness. And he then gives her a list of 118 exercises which she can do for improving the quality of consciousness. And these exercises are very interesting. I mean, they are all exercises in perception and imagination and becoming aware of every aspect of life and every event of life, from sneezing to eating and going to sleep to looking at the landscape. These are fascinating exercises, and again, I see no reason why we shouldn't profit by the experience which people have had in the past. Unfortunately, we have a tendency very often to neglect the most important discoveries. It is a very strange thing, for example, that Vito's discoveries were totally neglected. The various Oriental discoveries, some people have known about them here, but they've made very, very little effort to apply them. Even such experimental work has been done by Renshaw has been applied very little in the educational field, and yet it's quite obvious that it has great possibilities there. So, as I say, there's a great deal of sporadic and empirical material lying about, which requires to be brought together
and canalized for the purposes of education in the for the ultimate goal of making it possible for all individuals of every kind to realize more and more of their desirable personality. And I will close by making a kind of appeal. I don't think it is actually the business of any given academic institution to make these experiments, but I do very strongly feel that it is the business of any one of the great foundations to look into this problem. They are in a position, well, I mean, one of the troubles in an academic situation is that knowledge has unfortunately all been broken up into pigeonholes, and that each person lives in his pigeonhole, and it's very difficult to know exactly what's going on elsewhere. And you get to a point, I mean, I've seen this in some academic institutions, I trust not here, where because a piece of knowledge can't be fitted into any existing pigeonhole, it is regarded as non-existent. But unfortunately, there is a lot of knowledge which can't be fitted exactly into any pigeonhole, which is neither psychology nor physiology nor this nor sociology nor anthropology, but which is a little bit of everything. So that we do need some kind of creature which can run about on the woodwork between the pigeonholes and peep in here and there, and then correlate the material which he finds and which he finds also outside the system of pigeonholes. And this, I think, is precisely what a great foundation can do. And my belief is that if a sufficient amount of money and brains were devoted to this problem, that within 10 years we could start by collecting all the sporadic and empirical discoveries which have been made all over the world by all kinds of people at different periods of history, evaluate them, find how they can be fitted together. These are sort of empirical facts on the circumference of a circle. What is the central principle at the center of the circle? This we have to find out. Then we have to find out how these discoveries can be applied on every level of education from the kindergarten upwards. There's no doubt whatever the very simple forms of these techniques can be applied to very small children, and the earlier they are applied, the better. But it will mean that the more that they will, if their perceptions are trained, they will have, for example, not only will they probably, as the evidence shows, use their intelligences better and more attentively and therefore behave better in school and so forth, but they will also get a greater enjoyment of life. I mean, if the world seems as beautiful as it does to people with, I think, highly trained perception, I mean, if you can see, as Blake says, infinity in a grain of sand and eternity in a flower, well then you don't have to have all these imbecile distractions which are the bane of our modern life. I mean, the people find the world so dull that they are compelled to resort to cowboy stories on TV. But I mean, the world isn't as dull as this. The world happens to be the dangerous world, but it certainly is not an uninteresting world. And if we all started by having our perceptions well trained, we should A, enjoy the world a great deal more than we do, which I think is a very important thing. We should be more intelligent, and we should see, I think, we get away from these terrible, maniacal preoccupations with distraction. Well, then I have not very, very briefly, I'm afraid, must touch on certain other possibilities of development. One of our great problems, clearly, is the problem of love. How are we to increase the amount of love in the world and decrease the amount of hatred? This, of course, is the most basic of all, because it goes far beyond the merely intellectual and perceptual side of life. I think there are various ways of approach. I don't think any of them we don't know the secret yet. After all the great religions have been telling us that we must love our neighbors, we must have universal compassion, as the Buddhists say. But unfortunately, human history doesn't indicate that these teachings have had a very profound effect, and on a biological level we can see why the old brain, where the things of the passions of love and hate function, has not developed in the same way that the new brain has. The cerebral development has been entirely in the region of the cortex, which is essentially the intellectual region, whereas the other has remained very much what it was. And this does, I think, remain one of the gravest problems in our whole educational life. How to let off the steam of aggression and hatred, how to increase the volume of love. And, well, here again, I think there are certain empirical discoveries that have been made. For example, if we look in certain anthropological documents, we find that there have been tried to bring up their infants with, so to say, conditioned reflexes in the direction of love. I mean, the description of this is given in one of Margaret Mead's books of the Arapesh, who deliberately bring up their children in order to feel kindliness and affection, not only towards other human beings, but towards animals too. Well, we should not be ashamed of learning from these people, because very often extremely primitive people, on a limited scale, have made very, very interesting psychological discoveries. Then another interesting psychological discovery, I think one finds among the Polynesian people of the extended family, this whole group of families who are part of the child's family, and where there is a much wider range of affections, of rights and of duties than there is in the kind of extremely limited family which we've developed in our societies. I mean, here are two very interesting possibilities. Well, then there is the problem which William James touched on years ago, finding what he called the moral equivalent of war. Well, I don't know how we do this, but it remains extraordinarily important problem, and James did contribute something to it, but we have to go a good deal further than he went. And here again is another subject in which a good foundation should look into. Then we have this awful problem of organized prejudice. Professor Gordon Allport has written extensively on this subject, and it is, I must say, his findings are extremely depressing. I mean, he finds that probably about 4/5 of the inhabitants of this country suffer from organized prejudice, and that the means hitherto worked out for getting people out of this state, some are more effective than others, but none are 100% effective, and the most effective are, for practical reasons, very difficult to apply, because they require a kind of personal therapy, which naturally cannot be applied on a very large scale. So that here again we have a very difficult problem, but one which has to be looked into in the most intensive and practical way. One of the ways, of course, which makes itself obviously felt, is the way of teaching people to use language properly. It must not be imagined, because I've been talking about the non-verbal humanities, that I am uninterested in words. I make my living by handling words, and I am very interested in words in general. And it is, again, quite clear that if we could teach children to understand the nature of language and its limitations and the terrible traps which are embedded in the wrong use of language, we should perhaps do quite a lot to
to diminish this terrible burden of prejudice that exists within every society and between other societies. I mean, I think it is, of course, one of the curious facts that the linguistic analysis has been one of the great achievements of the 20th century, but it's remarkable how little of this achievement has percolated down into the general level of education. And yet here again, I feel that here is a field in which the foundation could make very valuable contributions. The final, and these, as I say, after 10 years, we might come up with a real program showing how, first of all, having looked into all these various scattered discoveries, empirical discoveries that have been made, finding out what are the sort of underlying principles which govern them, and then by practical experiments, seeing how the best of these ways of realizing potentialities might be applied on every level of education, from the kindergarten to postgraduate and far beyond, because after all, the education, if it's to be of any value, has to go on throughout life. Let me close now with something which has always touched me very much. There's a picture drawing by Goya in the Prado at Madrid, which I remember seeing years ago and was adopting as a motto, which I think should be the motto of every educational institution and of every individual, actually. The drawing represents a very old man hobbling along with the aid of two sticks, and underneath is written in Goya's very dashing handwriting the word "Aún aprendo," I am still learning. And with that, let me close. Thank you.
Dr. Huxley, we are deeply grateful to you for presenting this challenging message to us out of the richness and depth of your own experience. I'm sure that all of us will be a little more perceptive, I hope, in the days ahead.